Blog Talk Radio.
Each morning a missionary advertises with neon signs. He tells the native population that civilization is fine. And three educated savages holler from a bamboo tree. That civilization is a thing for me to see.
So bongo, 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 I don't wanna leave the Congo. Oh, no, 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 no. Bingo, bango, bongle, I'm so happy in the jungle, I refuse to go. Don't want no bright lights, false teeth, doorbells, landlords, I make it clear.
That no matter how they coax him,
I'll stay right here. I look through a magazine the missionary's wife conceals.
Magazine? What happens?
I see how people who are civilized bung you with automobiles.
You know you can get hurt that way, Daniel?
At the movies they have got to pay many coconuts to see.
What do they see, Danny?
Uncivilized pictures that the newsreel takes of me.
So, bongo, 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 he don't wanna leave the Congo. No, 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 no. Bongo, he's so happy in the jungle, he refused to go.
Don't want no penthouse, bathtub, streetcars, taxis, noise in my ear.
So no matter how they coax him,
I'll stay right here.
They hurry like savages to get aboard an iron train.
The Tringalingo Hula Humble Express.
And though it's smoky and it's crowded, they're too civilized to complain.
Aloha toho sahi mahena.
When they've got 2 weeks vacation, they hurry to vacation ground.
What do they do, Danny?
They swim and they fish, but that's what I do all year round.
So, bongo, 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 I don't wanna leave the Congo. No, 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 no. Bingo, bango, bongo, I'm so happy in the jungle, I refuse to go.
Don't want no jailhouse,
shotgun,
fish hooks,
golf club,
I got my spear.
So no matter how they coax him,
I'll stay right here.
They have things like the autumn bomb,
so I think I'll stay where I am.
Civilization, I'll stay right here.
Danny, I know exactly how you feel. Hey, everybody. James Bostic here. A conservative's perspective on Patriot Nation Radio. Yeah, it's Tuesday, 7 o'clock. We're live, theoretically. That's how the thing is supposed to work. And it's good to be here with you. And we do it live Tuesday, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We have a recorded version of the program as well that goes out on the Mojo 50 Radio Network, mojo50.com. If you aren't listening, you should be, because it is the very best in libertarian and conservative talk radio, mojo50.com. The capitalists will sell us the rope with which to hang them. Now, there's very little evidence that Vladimir Lenin uttered those exact words. What he did say, however, was more precise, if less catchy. They, being the capitalists, will furnish credits which will serve us for the support of the Communist Party in their countries, and by supplying us materials and technical equipment which we lack, we will restore our military industry necessary for our future attacks against our suppliers. To put it in other words, they will work on the preparation of their own suicide. Excuse me. Now, while Lenin's Soviet Union has receded into the pages of history, the Leninist mentality is still a very current event. And today on Wall Street, in the Silicon Valley, in Washington, too many people, too many Americans play deaf, dumb, and blind while selling rope. And the buyer of that rope is Beijing. And by rope, I'm talking very specifically about technology, money, intelligence, or even political support given to the communist regime. This rope enhances the military or the strategic capabilities of Beijing. And anything that advances their position in competition with the United States, they covet. Now, for decades, the proverbial wisdom has been that China was going to liberalize. We've been told by political figures and members of the business class that China would become more open, that China wasn't a threat. It was a Western wannabe. Give them free trade, access to technology and American capital, and they would become more like us. And this attitude has proliferated into a new establishment consensus, one that conveniently enriches many American elites. Excuse me. Beijing is happy to encourage this false assumption to advance their own very different political agenda. Of course, China hasn't liberalized. It's become more aggressive and repressive. Yet those elites who advised us on such a course of action got fabulously wealthy along the way. Should we let lobbyists represent Chinese companies in the quarters of American power? Should we be investing our 401ks in Chinese companies? Should we keep thinking, against all evidence, that we can engage with China and make it a positive force on the planet? A quarter century ago, it might have been reasonable for America's elite to believe that they could make Beijing more America-friendly by cultivating relationships with certain Chinese officials. But the exact opposite has happened. Beijing forged ties and gave money in deals to certain American elites who became more friendly to the Beijing regime. Don't try saying that fast. The culpability of those elites in what we're experiencing today, which is, of course, an increasingly powerful and increasingly aggressive China, cannot be overstated. Members of this special class either seek or are approached with lucrative deals and market access, accolades, in return, naively or not, strategic and economic benefits flow to the Beijing regime. This has been a vital approach pursued by the communist government, a strategy first proposed by Mao in 1956. The doctrine was called Make the Foreign Serve China. More than 60 years later, the strategy has not only become more aggressive, Beijing offers deals, inducement, praise, and access to seduce foreign elites into serving their interests. As Professor Anne Marie Brady, a premier specialist in Chinese influence operations, puts it, Beijing forges partnerships of mutual advantage with highly prominent foreign figures who can bring commercial or political advantages to China. In the world of espionage, practitioners use the term elite capture to describe successful efforts to essentially buy off members of a country's leadership. Opportunities to get wealthy are a key motivator. Beijing hopes that at a minimum, this approach will neutralize members of the elite by making them less critical or resistant to their policies, or at a maximum, turn them into actual advocates for Beijing's position. But for some reason, there are other motives beyond just money. As we're going to find out through Pete Schweitzer's book, Red Handed, too many of America's political, technical, and finance elites share an infatuation with dictatorship. they seem quite content, even, you know, endorse the idea that we should trust people to pick their breakfast cereal, but not their government leaders. They believe the Beijing dictatorship is more efficient, even a better system overall, than representative democracy. Their endorsements are often quoted by Chinese government media. In fact, basically, American elites are granting legitimacy to the Chinese government, and by doing so, they're rewarded with large financial deals. Look at the NBA. Look at Hollywood. Look at Disney. Now, there will be those prominent figures who that we look at and we scrutinize that are going to point to a negative statement that they've made about Beijing as evidence that they're tough on China, but largely that is a diversion. When it comes to buying off American politicians, the Chinese communists don't really require them to toe the party line. They really don't care about that. They, very pragmatically, will accept some level of public criticism from the people with whom it's working. You see, it gives the traders they imagine it to give them a mask of invincibility or invisibility. I'm not really sure. Maybe invincibility. They'll look to this. They'll take the negative statements or these critical statements that they've made of communist China, and they'll say, "Hey, look, man, I'm anti-communist as they come." But you know, then we find out of all these different holdings in their financial portfolios or in their business endeavors that are tied to China. We're going to get into that in just a little bit. The idea is called big help with a little bad mouth. So in other words, China is perfectly happy to accept this criticism made by those people whom they're paying off, because it gives these guys some legitimacy. Ha! There we go. A mask of legitimacy. That's where I was wanting to go with that. By saying, you know, hey, look at all these things I've said. Never mind what you said. What have you been doing? And like Michael Cutler, I'm going to tie all this stuff up here in just a little bit. As long as these people that have come under China's financial influence deliver on the policy concessions or the technological concessions or the economic concessions that, you know, China is looking for them to influence, it's fine. They can pretty much say what they want. So who exactly are these American elites who indeed, if not in word, wittingly or unwittingly, promote the dictatorial Beijing government, the communist Chinese? Some of the most prominent names in big tech, in Wall Street, and American politics are going to figure into the story that we're going to be looking at over the next few weeks. And the book that we're going to be drawing this from, Red Handed by Pete Schweitzer, is it's going to confirm a lot of things we've already known. You know, I'm just about 60. Excuse me. A ruggedly handsome 60, but 60 nonetheless. So I've been around a while. And one of the things about being around a while is I have been around long enough now to where I can see certain patterns. And looking back over the arc of, let's say, the last, what year is this? 2022. Okay. Let's go back to 10 years ago. No, let's go back 20 years ago. Let's go back into the Clintons, 25, 30 years ago. Stories will come out. Allegations will be made. In those days, the crusading journalists of the air weren't as numerous as they are now. And, you know, there's a lot of independent stuff going on, you know, independent people that are doing terrific work. And we find out, I think, more these days than we would. But the point is, allegations are made, cover-ups are made, certain patterns are being established. And finally, you look at it and you go, well, they're guilty as, you know, whatever it is. And how many times has that happened? How many times have our suspicions, our suppositions on these political intrigues and scandal and theater that we see all the time, some of it serious, some of it not, but, you know, we look at it, how many times have our suspicions ultimately been confirmed? Case in point, the whole Russia collusion thing. You know what that was, that Donald Trump was a Soviet agent, you know, under the direct orders of Vladimir Putin, and that Putin interfered with the election to get his sleeper agent, Donald Trump, in the White House to convert us all to communism. Okay, well, that didn't happen. The truth was, the whole thing was concocted by the Hillary Clinton campaign and her contacts through a convoluted back channel between the State Department and the Central Intelligence Agency and the Clinton supporters throughout the State Department, the Justice Department, the intelligence community. And they came up with this crazy ass thing about Donald Trump being in Moscow at a hotel that Barack Obama allegedly was in, and he wanted this specific room. He wanted the Obama presidential suite at this hotel, and then he hired a couple of Russian hookers to cavort and pee on the bed. And that made him happy. No, I'm not making it up. That's your Russian dossier. Now, the whole thing was a blow up. It came from people who were on the fringes of the Russian government, of British intelligence, of here in the United States, our own intelligence community. And it was just this weird spook operation that was bullshit. And after all these years, after two impeachments, after, you know, documents being declassified or information being released through various Freedom of Information Acts, what do we find? Yeah, it was bullshit. It was all bullshit all the time. We knew it. And just take that and expound upon it and think of all the things that have happened in politics where ultimately, you know, all these things that we suspected, that were denied so strenuously the whole time, turn out to be the truth. And we're going to look at the Chinese government, how these operations work. I have a 16-minute clip with Pete Schweitzer on a show that I would never have heard of. And, man, it's a pretty cool show if you want to know about what's going on in China. And it would suit us to know a lot about what's going on in China. It's called China Insider. And the host name was David Zhang. And it was... These are anti-communist guys. These are good guys, and they were talking to Pete Schweitzer, and he's expounding upon how the Chinese government is doing what it's doing, and I'm going to set it up to play here in just a little bit, and then we're going to move into the Bidens and some of the book. About 20 some years ago, 25, 30 years ago, maybe even a little bit longer, a couple of Chinese colonels. China and the People's Liberation Army in China wrote a book, Unrestricted Warfare. That book looked at the ideas and the tactics of how a lesser impoverished country like China, massive as it is, could use basically societal and cultural judo, jiu-jitsu, use the freedoms and the abilities that America has to their own benefit and get to the point to where, you know, they're the superpower. They're the ones that are establishing hegemony across the globe, and the United States is a secondary nation. And they're well on their way to doing it. And there are a lot of tactics involved in this unrestricted warfare. And it's not necessarily a military conflict. And when I say that, I don't, you know, it may not be a question of fleets or armored units or aerial bombardment wings or fighter squadrons. It may come in a lot of different ways. It may come societally. It may come culturally, economically. It may come through the media. It may come through politics. And that's how they're doing it, is by buying all these people off. And when we look, and we're going to look at the Bidens first. We're going to look at them before we look at anybody, because Joe Biden is President of the United States. He's Chief Executive of the United States. Pete, where are you, pal? Oh, Petey. Please tell me I put you in here, buddy. Ah, here we go. Okay. Again, a lot of this stuff that we're going to talk about, and some of these things that we're going to talk, especially with the Biden, came out in Pete Schweitzer's previous book, Secret Empires. But he expounds upon it because he has new information now that he wasn't privy to at that time, that really fleshes this thing out. And again, and this can't be stressed enough, everything in his books, everything, every footnote, every highlight, everything in his books is all open sourced. No anonymous sources, no secondhand innuendos, no gossip, no bullshit. Oh, wait, no, can you say innuendos? Okay. Anyway, okay, it's all there. It's all open sourced. It's for real. There's no questioning it. There's no, and there'll be tons of denying it, like we always see, but ultimately it is the truth. And, you know, it's going to scour through that dirt. This plow will scour through that dirt. Here it is. Okay. Now, this was from, it's pretty recent. The book just came out last week. I got it on Amazon through Kindle last Tuesday. I think it was Tuesday. Yeah, it came out on Tuesday. Anyway, so he probably did this Wednesday or Thursday for China Insider. Pete Schweitzer talking about how the Chinese government is using this money to buy off these people here, to purchase traitors. That's what.
America is under attack. The Chinese Communist Party has gotten in the pockets of the elites. By giving them lucrative policies in China and false promises, the United States has entangled itself with the devil. Among it all are corruption, bribery, and most of it all, power. What is the intention of the CCP to undo the moral fabrics of this society? Today I'm joined by Peter Schweitzer, author and president of the Government Accountability Institute. His new book, Red Handed, exposes it all. Welcome to China Insider. I'm David Zane. Happy Friday. Today, the U.S. and China relationship is rather sour, but in the past, China has employed many avenues to soften America's attitude towards it, including allowing the American elite classes to reap the benefits in China, or to disguise its real intention of promoting hegemony across Asia, and eventually compete against the U.S. to become number one. Just how has China co-opted economic partnerships and individual relations to get what they want in America? And how has Washington, Wall Street, and Silicon Valley fallen into the hands of the Red Devil? Today I'm joined by Peter Schweitzer, and he reveals it all in his new book, Red Handed, How America's Elites Get Rich Helping China Win. In his book, Peter outlines how the Chinese Communist Party attracts the billionaires in Silicon Valley, Google, Facebook, Tesla, Apple, all that and much more being exposed on the West Coast. Yet in Wall Street, in Washington, the political and financiers of American policies are also in the Chinese Communist Party loop. So why has the CCP resolved to corrupting the U.S. politicians and Wall Street firms to gain their reach? And how has the long arm of the Chinese Communist Party, its tangled roots decades in the making, this evil attempt to influence the United States and to grind down the Republic be stopped?
All right, Mr. Peter Schweizer, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about your book, Red-Handed.
Great to be here with you, David. Thanks for having me.
So I'm really interested to understand, you know, you started the book, the first chapter was called The Rope, and you went into details on sort of the background information of sort of how we got here. My question after reading this chapter was actually, you know, you mentioned the Chinese Communist Party is trying to compete with the United States to be number one. What's going to happen if American elites, you know, in Silicon Valley or in Washington, continues this type of behavior? If we went down this path, what could happen, you know, when, if China were to surpass us?
Well, I think if the CCP would win, and that means a fundamentally different world system economically. It also means that the United States isn't going to necessarily be occupied, but life here is going to be heavily influenced by what the regime in Beijing wants. So the stakes are very high. I think people obviously are very sympathetic and concerned what's happening to the Chinese people. But for some people who say, look, that's not my concern, this should be their concern because this is going to affect their life as well.
And you also went into a lot of details on the big tech areas, those you know, top elites there. Before we get to that, though, I have another question, actually. I think this was last year. There was a Chinese scholar that was doing a talk. His name is Di Dongsheng, and basically his whole argument is that China has, you know, it's in the pockets of Wall Street, and they have the influence there. So for a long time, they were able to influence a lot of the American decisions because, you know, you had Wall Street lobbying Washington. And so this negative cycle of China interfering in American politics continued for a while. What sort of happened, you know, in recent years that changed this dynamic a little bit?
Well, I think what's important for people to keep in mind is that Beijing doesn't have to lobby for its own interests because there's so many powerful interests in the United States that will lobby on their behalf. So you have Wall Street, which of course wants access to the Chinese market. It wants deals with the Chinese government. And unfortunately, the big players, BlackRock, Blackstone, they're all prepared to basically not criticize the regime, go along with the regime's policies in exchange for access to the market. When Donald Trump was elected and Trump started talking about some of these vital issues, Wall Street became the biggest voice for resisting Trump's policies. And that's kind of where we are today. These big Wall Street firms run by individuals who've benefited from the American system have become the biggest cheerleaders in many cases for this oppressive regime that may not be Marxist, but it's certainly Leninist. And that's, I think, what's appalling, what people need to realize is going on.
So then you spend a lot of time talking about individual big tech players like Elon Musk, you know, Facebook, Google, and all of these players. Why are they in this? You know, in China, Google and Facebook are not allowed to be, you know, operating in the consumer area. But why are they still in China, you know, in this economic side?
Well, I think they're there for a couple of reasons. First of all, they want to be further in the market, but they also want access to Chinese research and they want access to data. Data is so key when it comes to artificial intelligence. It's kind of the oil that is going to fuel artificial intelligence research. And the Chinese government, of course, has a lot of people to collect data from, and it also has no problems with invading privacy. They don't have privacy protections in China like we have here. I think that's part of it. The other part of it, though, is there is this strange sort of admiration that some of these individuals have for the dictatorial regime in Beijing. I mean, people like Elon Musk will say things about how the Chinese government is more efficient than the representative government of the United States, that the government there better represents the interests of the people. And so I don't think it's just about money. I don't think it's just about market access. I also think it's they are attracted to certain elements of the way in which the Chinese regime operates, particularly in the big tech space. I quote a professor from MIT in the 1970s who's talking about the dangers of technology. And one of the things he points out is that if you're in the computer programming space, you're kind of like a god. You get to design your own universe. You get to design all the players, how the universe is going to play. And I think that in some respects, some of these tech gurus sort of take that quality, that dictatorial quality they have in their own little silicon space, and they want to apply it to the rest of the world. So it's about money, but it's also about the appeal of this regime that works in their eyes so efficiently.
You know, this is the first time I've heard something like this, because I had this theory after Trump was banned from Twitter. The Chinese leader Xi Jinping, you know, one of my theories is that the reason why he decided to crack down on some of the tech companies in China himself was that this growth of the private capital, this growth of tech companies in China got so big that he was afraid, you know, it could happen to him too. So, you know, you mentioned that they have this garner for power, this idea that they want to control a certain aspect. How much of this do you think is being actualized when they deal with China?
I think it has a lot to do. I mean, Beijing is very sophisticated in appealing not only to the pocketbooks of these players, but also to their egos. So Bill Gates, the founder of Microsoft, is a great example of this. You know, he's been given awards in China. He was the Communist Party newspaper identified him as one of the top 50 foreigners that have transformed and made, you know, the regime successful. He also is an advisor of sorts to the Chinese government. He's a member of something called the Chinese Academy of Engineering, which sounds very, you know, sort of friendly and non-political. It's actually, of course, an organization run by the Communist Party, and its goal is to advise the Chinese government on technology policy. So you have a guy like Bill Gates who certainly invests in China in companies that have military application. Microsoft, of course, is very active in China. But the Chinese regime also appeals to that sense of honor and admiration. So it's an appeal to ego, and it's very, very successful, I think, not just with Bill Gates, who will never criticize the Beijing regime for anything, but it works with other people in the tech space as well, and, of course, Wall Street.
So why do you think that, you know, with this book, of course, you talk a bit about they need to get influence in American politics through these people. So why do you think that in particular China has decided to pursue this route? Is it something in the United States economy or this way we operate? Is there something else? Like, why have they decided that targeting elites is the way to go?
I think it's a brilliant strategy, and it makes sense from a strategic standpoint. You know, if China and the Beijing regime were put in a situation where they had to go head-to-head with the United States militarily, economically, in terms of alliances, it would take a very long time for them to get to a position where they could go toe-to-toe and win. And, of course, it would be massively destructive for both sides. So what they've done is essentially adopted a strategy which says we're going to co-opt the elites. If we can co-opt the elites and the decision makers in the United States, you're effectively cutting off the head of the person you're fighting. So imagine you're boxing somebody, right, and they're bigger and stronger than you. Well, if you can get in their head not to be aggressive, not to be a friend, not to, you know, not to fight, you're going to win the boxing match. And that's effectively what they've done. I think it's a brilliant strategy. They've employed it in other countries like New Zealand and Australia that are certainly smaller. The United States is a bigger apple to bite, so to speak, but they've been very successful in Washington, D.C., Silicon Valley, and Wall Street with the biggest names and the biggest players in all three of those areas.
My last question is, you know, I want to know what the inspiration for looking into the Chinese connection, because this seems like a very sensitive topic, you know, in recent years, as you highlighted, the roots are very deep, right? It's entangled.
Yeah.
So why do you think at this moment, you know, this is an issue that needs to be addressed?
Well, because I think we're seeing a convergence of some issues in the United States. I mean, the promise was that if we engaged in China, gave them access to technology in Western markets, sold them blue jeans and let them watch some movies, that the Chinese government would become more like ours. That hasn't happened. What I think has happened is that certain institutions in the United States have become more like Beijing. I think the censorship that you see with big tech in Silicon Valley is not as crude, not as all-encompassing as it is in Beijing, but some of the elements, I think, are very similar. I think this is a critical issue because I think it goes to the heart of the future of the country. It is a sensitive topic. I make the point in the book repeatedly that the issue is not the fact that they are Chinese. It's this dictatorial regime. Ronald Reagan drew this distinction during the Cold War that our adversary is the Soviet regime. It's the Kremlin. It's not the Russian people. And I feel the same way in this particular circumstance. So if people can see that what happens in China, this oppressive regime, what it's doing in China is going to affect them. These things don't happen in isolation, that there is a competition between Beijing and Washington to see who is going to be the supreme power. President Xi has said he wants to seize the commanding heights in technology so that China can be number one. This is going to be a day of reckoning for the United States, and I would rather us deal with it now rather than down the road when it's too late.
And I think something that just popped up in my head when you said, this the day of reckoning is, you'd rather have it now than later, is something else you mentioned was when you were speaking about the next generation, I guess, by 2050, you mentioned here, which is two centuries after the Opium War, that Xi is, of course, trying to restore this emperor-like status for him and then, this middle kingdom for China. That's the vibe that he's giving off right now. What's the obstacle, in the way? Of course, the United States is a big obstacle. Does he see this plan of corrupting the elites as a part of that strategy to restore his quote-unquote rightful middle kingdom?
Absolutely. I think it's the heart of the strategy because, again, if you can basically cut off the head of the snake, you don't have to deal with the snake. And this strategy of what in Chinese intelligence they call elite capture is the direction that they are going. They don't care if American politicians are Republicans or Democrat. They will allow certain criticisms. There's a strategy that loosely translated into English, is big help with a little bad mouth. That's the rough translation. And essentially what it means is that they don't mind if American politicians talk about the Uyghurs occasionally or say we should have a diplomatic boycott, whatever that means, of the Beijing Olympics. They're fine with that. The question is, as long as you're helping them on the main tenets of what they want, which is access to American finance and access to American technology and a few other things, they're happy if they're criticizing them from time to time on the Uyghurs. And that is the strategy they're employing. And I think they are very successful with it. And unless we start to take radical action, we will lose. There's no question in my mind. We will lose because our elites will be happy to sell out, collect their money, and position themselves to be in elite positions for generations to come.
And last point, was there anything you wanted to add to the conversation?
No, I just think this has been very helpful. I think the work that you do with your news organization is fantastic and is an important voice to get the word out there. And, my sense of what people have to understand is, the nature of the Chinese regime is such that it cannot be trusted. It cannot be trusted with its own people, and I don't think it can be trusted in its relationship with us, and we need to keep that in mind with everything.
Well, Peter Schweizer, thank you so much for the answers today to my questions, and thanks for coming on today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for watching tonight's episode. Comment below and tell us what you think about the CCP's attempt to influence America. Join us on Monday, where we'll be speaking to Mr. Roger Gartside, author of the book China Coup.
North 40 tone. There ain't nothing you can tell me I don't already know. I got a rocket in my pocket and I'm ready to go. Let's go someplace.
rocket in my pocket and the fuse is lit.
Too many nights in a roadhouse, too much wine, women and song. Too many days on the highway, then I run around all night long. I take a good look in the mirror, in the cold gray light of dawn. Too many nights in a roadhouse, run a little good boy wrong. Running with my buddies on the wild side, caused me a run of bad luck. Out all night with a roadhouse crowd, now I'm down to my last $2. Working way too hard, trying to live too fast, putting too many wrinkles on. Too many nights in the old roadhouse, run a little good boy wrong. Too many nights in a roadhouse, too much wine, women and song. Too many days on a highway, then I run around all night long. I take a good mirror in the cold gray light of dawn. Too many nights in a roadhouse, run a little good boy wrong. I was living, and it wasn't too hard to tell. Had the blues come around when the sun went down, and the days didn't fare too well. I sure did want a taste of the good life, till the good times come along. Too many nights in a roadhouse, run a little good boy wrong. Too many nights in a roadhouse, too much wine, women and song. Too many days on the highway, then I run around all night long. I take a good look in the mirror, in the cold gray light of dawn. Too many nights in a roadhouse, run a little good boy wrong. Too many nights in a roadhouse, just run a little good boy.
Brother, can I attest to that? Too many nights in a roadhouse. James Bostic, conservative perspective on Patriot Nation Radio here at Blog Talk Radio, doing it live Tuesday, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time with a recorded version of the program that goes out on Sundays and apparently more likely Thursdays as well. The Sunday show that's recorded, you can find it on Mojo 5.0 Radio, Sundays at 4 p.m. Eastern, and then we'll probably just run that as an archive program Thursdays. Now, I used to do Thursdays live, and I've gotten a couple of questions. Hey, what's the deal? What's going on? What are you doing? Well, none of your business. No, it's there's been some things happening behind the scenes I haven't really gone into, and I'm not going to yet. But there's a teaching certification that I'm kind of keen on getting, and there's an opportunity to do it, but it's right here and now, and it takes place on Thursday nights. The class that meets to help study for these certification tests, it's kind of like a comprehensive kind of exam. They meet on Thursday nights, so something had to give, and this is pretty important, so we're going to do that. We'll be back Thursdays, or I'll find another day. Excuse me, I'll find another day in the week somewhere around. It's hard to say, but for right now, Tuesdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, is going to be live, and we're happy to be here with you. You all heard that Trump said Biden's son has security companies all over the world. The speaker said in a smooth, elegant Mandarin accent. But who helped Biden's son build his global companies? The question came from a slender Chinese academic named Di Zhongsheng. We just talked about him in the clip there with Pete Schweider and David Zhang earlier. He stood in front of a large audience in Shanghai. It was November 28, 2020, just weeks after the United States presidential election. And beyond the hundreds who had gathered in the auditorium, many more watched the streamed version online, courtesy of Guan Video, an influential Chinese nationalist website. Zhongsheng is more than a random academic. He is an associate dean at Renmin University, which is an elite institute in Beijing that boasts prominent alumni high in the Communist Party and the Communist government, including Politburo members and ambassadors. He sits near the center of power. Di Zhongsheng has also worked with the Chinese government's official propaganda organs to spread pro-Beijing material in the United States, including Washington, D.C. The speech was part of a prestigious forum that featured talks by Chinese luminaries, such as the former directors of the Asian Development Bank and of the International Department of China's Central Bank. Zhongsheng's remarks struck a nerve. The crowd, no doubt including high-ranking Communist Party officials, was actively engaged. They smiled and laughed and applauded as he discussed the global stage and China's influence in the United States. Zhongsheng noted that Beijing had old friends inside America's core circle of power, mentioning Wall Street in particular as a strong ally. He reassured the audience that Beijing could settle issues with people at the top in the United States. When he asked that question about Hunter Biden rhetorically, obviously, about Biden's son's deals, the audience laughed knowingly. There are indeed buy and sell transactions involved in here. So I think at this particular time, it is of strategic and tactical value for us to show goodwill. Zhongsheng's comments about Chinese influence among the elites in the United States were unusually candid for a Chinese official in public, but they were also direct and on the nose. The fact that he referenced Chinese commercial dealings with the Biden family, which Schweitzer talked about in his first book in the expose, Secret Empires, and that was about 2017. Anyway, it surprised the Beijing government that he would speak so candidly and openly about this. And the speech was promptly removed from the country's social media platforms after it started to go viral. So the answer to Zhongsheng's question is that, and people, I'm just going to go ahead and tell you now, all this stuff is open sourced. What I'm telling you comes from Schweitzer's book. There's no question about its authenticity. There's no question about its accuracy. Buckle up and get ready to get really, really pissed off. We're going to start with the Bidens, but that's just where we're starting. Financiers with close ties to the highest levels of Chinese intelligence helped Hunter Biden build or join several global companies. Now, there are important reasons for Beijing to want their commercial ties with the Biden family to remain obscure. Now, the greater question is, why would the Biden family want commercial ties to China? Could Hunter Biden not trade on his last name to open doors in less authoritarian countries? And remember, bear in mind, what we're talking about here in this particular instance applies to the Bidens, but at the same time, it applies generally to so many other people we're going to talk about. Chinese officials have cultivated these commercial ties for more than a decade. Other Biden family members have happily pursued financial relationships too, eager to cash in with lucrative deals. So since Peter Schweitzer first broke the story about these ties in Secret Empires in 2018, he's gained access to a whole bunch of new documentary evidence. What it comes down to is this. The new evidence makes clear that the Biden family received some $31 million from Chinese businessmen with very close ties to the highest levels of Chinese intelligence during and after Joe Biden's tenure as vice president. Even as you and I are talking about this right now, some of those relationships remain intact. You have to be struck by the extraordinary concentration of Chinese intelligence ties by the business people making these deals with the Bidens. These ties reach into the highest of the high levels, the most secret levels of the Chinese intelligence community. It includes the former head of the Ministry of State Security, the head of foreign intelligence recruitment for Chinese intelligence, and a cluster of United Front organizations used for intelligence operations in the West. We'll talk about them later and their significance. $31 million. Now, these new sources of information provide even more evidence that this is a story not about just Hunter Biden, but Joe Biden himself. To some degree, for the period that the research covers here, Hunter Biden and Joe Biden had intertwined their finances. Hunter Biden privately complained to family members about paying his father's bills. "I love all of you," he wrote to his daughter Naomi on January 3rd of 2019. "But I don't receive any respect, and that's fine, I guess. It works for you, apparently. I hope you all can do what I did and pay for everything for this entire family for 30 years. It's really hard. But don't worry, unlike Pop, I won't make you give me half your salary." Other correspondence confirms that the Vice President of the United States, signified by the initials JRB, Joseph Robinette Biden, was mentioned in emails discussing payments or financial opportunities. The new sources of information come from the Secret Service travel logs, the emails of Bevin Cooney, who was a Hunter Biden associate, the United States Oversight Committee's report on what was going on with this, Tony Bobulinski's emails, who was also a former former business associate through some of the Hunter Biden's business holdings, and the laptop from hell, Hunter Biden's emails from his own laptop, close to 25,000 there alone, and they include emails and messages sent to colleagues, partners, family members. And during all this, Hunter Biden has never denied that the emails are genuine, even admitting that they could be his. Were the emails false? We can assume he would vigorously challenge their authenticity if that were the case. He hasn't. As he first stated in Secret Empires, in 2009, Hunter Biden joined forces with a couple of buddies from Yale, Devin Archer and Christopher Hines. Christopher Hines, daughter of Teresa Hines Carey, wife of former Secretary of State, I was for it before I was against it, John Kerry, John Effin Kerry, that John Kerry. So these three stooges set up a series of businesses. And the first one they established was Rosemont Capital, and after that, Rosemont Seneca Partners. They also set up Rosemont Realty and Rosemont Seneca Technology Partners. And rather than locate the shop in Manhattan, the world's financial capital, Rosemont Seneca leased space in Washington, D.C. They occupied an all-brick building on Wisconsin Avenue, just 2 miles from both Joe Biden's office in the White House and his residence at the Naval Observatory. Hunter Biden and his partners constructed a remarkable constellation of limited liability companies, many of which served as pass-throughs to manage the flow of foreign money. These included Oldacre, Biden and Belair LLP, Seneca Global Advisors, Rosemont Seneca Advisors, RSP Investments Eudora, RSTP1, RSTP2, Alpha and Bravo, Owasco, and Scannatelli's. Numerous emails, including the corporate documents between these two people, clearly indicate that the management of these LLCs, all these, I guess we can call them shell companies, because this is where all the funny, the foreign money was passed through and fundamentally laundered. So the management of these shell companies and Hunter Biden's own finances were handled by a guy named Eric Schwerin, and he was a former Clinton administration official. Hunter Biden's defenders would have us believe a very wholly benign narrative, and that was that he had a small role in some medium-sized deals with profit-driven Chinese investors drawn in only by his business acumen. The facts add up something else completely. As you have seen, there are indications that Hunter and Joe Biden's financial fortunes have been fused together. Barely a year and a half into the Obama administration, Hunter and his business partners in Rosemont Seneca began drawing up a memo called JRB Future Memo. And no, it ain't James Robert Bostic. It's Joseph Robinette Biden. And what this was, it concerned the opportunity, you know, what it talked about was commercial opportunities for Joe Biden after he left the Obama administration. Mike has a pretty good draft of this done, Shoren wrote to Hunter Biden. Does it make sense to see if your dad has some time in the next couple of weeks while you're in D.C. to talk about it? Your dad just called me about his mortgage and mentioned that he'd be out a lot soon and not really back until Labor Day. So it dawned on me it might be a good time, and he could also use some news about his future earnings potential. So Hunter Biden has the guy that's running his shell companies and managing his own books, setting up possible money-making deals for Joe once he gets out of office. So exactly what future earnings the vice president would be discussing with Sharon, we don't really know. But the Bidens, father and son together, apparently followed a business model that was play for pay, offering access to the highest levels of power in Washington in exchange for big money international deals. So locating Rosemont Seneca Partners in Washington, D.C. fits in with this model beautifully, because access to the White House, particularly for foreign elites, represented a central selling point in securing these private deals. this setup is exactly what Hunter Biden had in mind clearly when dealing with foreign elites. And we can look at an example of an email that Hunter sent to a prospective partner in Mexico, a guy named Miguel Alemán. And in a February 2016 email, Hunter, who was arriving in Mexico City aboard Air Force Two with Dad, was furious because he had granted Alemán access to the highest reaches in Washington, but the deals he wanted in return had yet to materialize. We're arriving late tonight on Air Force Two in Mexico City. We'll be there for Thursday. I'm attending a meeting with President N of Mexico with Dad. Jeff is with me on the plane, and he will be with us all day. Would love to see you, but you never respond. I'm really upset by it. You respond when it's something you need. You're the most generous person I know, but what the... We have so many great things to do together, and I want you at the plane when the VP lands with your mom and dad, and you completely ignore me. I've looked at what your family has done, and I want to follow in that tradition, and you always say you'll help, but I haven't heard from you since I got you a meeting for Carlos and your dad. We've been talking about business deals and partnerships for 7 years, and I really appreciate you letting me stay at your resort villa, but I've brought every single person you've ever asked me to bring to the effing White House and the Vice President's house and the inauguration, and then you go completely silent. I don't hear from you for months. I don't know what it is that I did, but I'd like to know why. I've delivered on every single thing you've ever asked, and you make me feel like I've done something to offend you. This was the business model. This is how they operated. Now, in the case of the Alemán family, access to the White House didn't land Hunter a profitable deal. China, however, a completely different story. So Hunter's Rosemont Seneca quickly set its sights on Zhangu, the Middle Kingdom. And as we'll see from Schweitzer's book, a number of Chinese officials, several with intelligence connections, were all too happy to go into business with the son of the vice president. It is likely this is because they have different goals than just making money. Doing business in China often entails having the right political contacts and relationships, having a powerful name, a powerful family name can be of enormous benefit. So to do business in China, as he first reported in Secret Empires, Hunter Biden and his partners, John Kerry's stepson, and some other ne'er-do-well from Yale, they set up Rosemont Seneca, and they partner with another politically connected consultancy called the Thornton Group. Now, the Thornton Group had on its board of directors a fellow named James Bulger. Now, James Bulger was the nephew of the mob hitman James Whitey Bulger, who was on the hook for 19 murders. He took off. They found him. He was arrested, tried, and convicted. They sent him to prison where the mob guys killed him. Yeah. Mob guys. I mean, that's what happens. So Whitey's younger brother, Billy Bulger, is James Bulger, the managing director of this firm. That's his uncle. He was also connected in the Massachusetts State Senate. And Bulger's partners in this venture included a guy named Michael Lin, who was a co-founder of the group, who had considerable connections in Beijing. Originally, he was from Taiwan, but he moved to Beijing in 2005, and he worked as the head of investments for Peking University founder, a powerful investment vehicle that has, again, and you're going to hear this a lot, strong connections among the top leaders of the Chinese Communist Party. We're going to find out that this particular company, Peking University founder, also has deep commercial ties with Chinese intelligence. So it was Michael Lin who gave Hunter Biden entree into the highest levels of Chinese leadership. Less than a year after opening Rosemont Seneca, Hunter Biden and Devin Archer are in China with access to to those of great financial as well as political influence. The Thornton Group's account of the encounter on their Chinese language website was at the time revealing because it said, Chinese executives extended their warm welcome to the Thornton Group with its U.S. partner, Rosemont Seneca chairman, Hunter Biden, and in parentheses, second son of the now Vice President, Joe Biden. The meeting's purpose was to explore the possibility of commercial cooperation and opportunity. These meetings were the largest and most powerful government-backed financial institutions in China. In 2010, they met with high-ranking senior Chinese officials, including the head of private equity for the Chinese government's China Investment Corporation. Now, the timing on this is important. Hunter's meeting in China occurred just before Vice President Biden met with Chinese President Hu Jintao during the nuclear security summit in Washington. Joe Biden would emerge ultimately as the point man in the Obama administration's foreign policy on China, so he would be a clear focus of Chinese attention. Hunter Biden was the centerpiece of these initial meetings, not necessarily for what he brought to the meeting, but simply for his participation. The first trip in April was a success. James Bulger, nephew of the hitman, writes to Hunter, "Your presence was a huge boon to us all." Why? Hunter can't speak Chinese. And he sure didn't know anything about international business, but he was still the vice president's son. That's what he brought to the table. In 2011, Devin Archer met again with Chinese officials at the highest levels and apparently planned to underscore the partner's exclusive access to the vice president by bringing, by bringing signed copies of Joe Biden's book, presumably the one he written in 2007, Promises to Keep. "Any chance I can get three Biden books to leave with the China Investment Corporation and with the China International Trust and Investment Corporation and Chairman Zhang of Wahaha?" No, I didn't make that up. Wahaha. Chairman Zhang of Wahaha, one of China's richest men. Now, this is where we get to the elite capture part of the deal. For Beijing, a commercial relationship with the Bidens would offer an opportunity for elite capture. Joe Biden had already painted a relatively favorable view of the Beijing regime in public statements. Hunter and his team did get meetings with these dominant financial institutions. CITIC reports directly to the People's Republic of China State Council, the most powerful governing body in the country, and the China Investment Corporation is one of the government's sovereign wealth funds. These are the people that fund the Chinese government. In April 2011, Hunter and his partners returned to Asia, visiting China, the mainland, and they also visited Taiwan. Now, according to internal Rosemont emails, Hunter doesn't appear to have had a heavy lift of Rosemont endeavors. "What is the first meeting I have to attend?" he asked Devin Archer in an email. So basically, the guy's a rubber stamp. He's a figurehead. He's his old man's son. That's what he brings, his old man's influence and juice. So when they returned to Washington, D.C., Hunter's associates emphasized the importance of the vice president's son sending personal notes to Chinese officials. His partners ensured that there should be a thank you email from Hunter to every meeting contact we made. Now, again, every single one of these money companies that Hunter Biden and Devin Archer and Heinz 57 met with, I can't remember the guy's first name, Eddie Heinz. They're all connected to the head of the Chinese government. They're all connected to the Chinese military. They're all connected to Chinese intelligence. And this intelligence isn't something, it's not information they put away for a quiz show or for a weekend game of Trivial Pursuit. You may as well say this is military intelligence. Because they have understood that greed is a very effective way to weaponize these relationships. Case in point. On this particular trip in 2011, Hunter and his partners met with someone that they dubbed the super chairman, who would play a central role in securing a large deal. Now, the super chairman is a man named Che Feng, a Chinese tycoon with, again, say it with me, yes, close ties to Chinese intelligence. The son of a People's Liberation Army soldier, Che was a successful businessman and controlled numerous companies. He would become a major player in the relationship between Hunter Biden and Beijing. Described in the Western press as a shadowy and discreet investor, Che perhaps needed to remain in the shadows and demonstrate extreme discretion because of his very powerful friends and family members. His father-in-law was a governor of the People's Bank of China and was president of the National Council for Social Security Fund. That's the government retirement fund in China. The National Council later became an investor in Hunter's private equity deal, but even more important, Che had other disturbing ties. He was business partners with a man named Ma Jian, the vice minister of state security, fundamentally China's KGB. Ma Jian also had financial ties with Peking founder, where Michael Lin had worked. Reportedly, Ma Jian was the director of the ministry's number 8 bureau, which targeted foreigners with its counterintelligence apparatus, mainly diplomats, businessmen, reporters. French intelligence scholar Roger Falajot said that Ma Jian oversaw operations in where? North America. Yeah. He was a busy man. Beyond his intelligence work, he reportedly had 6 mistresses. Well, that's good to know. Okay, well, I don't even know why they took it, but okay. Anyway, so evidently the cat's really good at multitasking. So the hazards of a Chinese businessman, and we're talking about more than one here, with close ties to the top ranks of Beijing's spy community, conducting financial transactions with the son of the United States Vice President cannot be overstated. How did this not set off national security or ethics alarm bells in Washington is simply a wonder in and of itself. According to email correspondence, Hunter's relationship with the super chairman was warm, and in October of 2011, Hunter and his partners returned to Hong Kong as Che's guests. The super chairman put them up in the luxurious Four Seasons Hotel in Hong Kong for more discussions about business opportunities. You know, in the stripping business, they call them gentlemen's clubs because they don't want to call them strip joints, right? Okay. Well, who goes to gentlemen's clubs? Well, gentlemen, obviously, to engage in what? Gentlemanly activities because we're gentlemen. That's what this more discussions about business opportunities says to me, okay? That we're going to crash at the Four Seasons. I'm going to put you boys up in first class style. And we're going to talk about how much money is it going to take for us to bribe your ass and make you dependent upon our cash in order that we can have you sway American attitudes about communist China. Now, at this time, Hunter Biden is traveling with Secret Service protection. So for the meeting, a Chinese partner instructed Hunter to send the Secret Service detail to him to check things out. And when the Secret Service wished to call to check things, as they always do, please make them call Jonathan or me. The plan was to fuse Chinese financial might to those with access to the highest levels of power in the Western world. No, this is not a James Bond story, okay? This is not a James Bond script. Ian Fleming didn't write this. Tom Clancy wasn't involved with this. Alistair MacLean had nothing to do with this. So together, the super chairman and Rosemont's people form an entity called Bohai Harvest, RST, to create a pecuniary powerhouse funded by China's biggest government-backed financial institutions, the son of a sitting vice president. Biden and his partners were enthusiastic about what the super chairman was bringing them, an opportunity to work with the largest state-owned financial conglomerates, or that kind of high-power companies. Imagine we will be sitting on the same board with CIC or the other Chinese huge investment or fund houses, not fund houses. One of those big fund houses was Harvest Fund Management, which was headed by another key figure in the Biden's family deals in China, Henry Zhao, or Zhao Zhujun. I can't believe I'm getting these right, and I'm probably not. He was the chairman of Harvest, and he was also the company's, Chinese Communist Party's general secretary. The mission of our party is to bring happiness to people, he proclaimed, and to revive the nation for people. Again, another figure, Zhao, who would steer money to Hunter Biden, also had ties to, yes, Chinese intelligence.
What a stupid son of a
What was that, Joe?
What a stupid son of a bitch.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I agree. So one of Zhao's companies, Harvest Global Investments, was co-founded by Jia Lingqing, daughter of Ji Chunhuang, who was a member of the Politburo Standing Committee at the time. Her father, I told you guys we're going to get pissed off. Her father is the former Minister of State Security, which meant he was in charge of Secret Service, espionage, and domestic and overseas intelligence work. There is no one more powerful in the Chinese intelligence community. Starting in 1985, he ran the Foreign Espionage Section for the Ministry of State Security. He eventually ran the entire intelligence service till 1998, when he became head of public security, which put him in charge of other intelligence operations, the national police, even the Chinese gulags. He was, in short, the man who ran China's spy apparatus for 13 years. He helped develop China's deep water fish strategy, developing thousands of special agents hidden in the deepest strata of the society of the enemy to work with his intelligence services. His in-laws connected to the Communist Party, your father-in-law, Liu Yunshan, head of the Chinese Communist Party's propaganda department during early negotiations and up until a year before Harvest secured its deals with Hunter. This seductive and lucrative deal that Hunter was now putting into place, creating Bohai Harvest, involved two financiers with ties to the, say it with me, highest levels of Chinese intelligence, a $1 billion private equity deal that Schweitzer first talked about in Secret Empires. And what we now know are the roles that were played by the spy-connected super chairman and Henry Zhao. That was his name in America. We're going to call him Henry Zhao because I don't want to go, we're just not going to go back. The deal was negotiated quietly. And Hunter's partners wanted to keep his involvement in the agreement private, at least until the deal was sealed. Please, remember, I haven't informed anyone in my office about the reason for my trip to Hong Kong last week. James Bulger wrote to Hunter Biden and others after he returned from the trip. So no one knows that Hunter was with me last week. I'm going to keep this effort quiet until we have a contract in place. What happens in Hong Kong stays in Hong Kong, replied Eric Schwerin. Now, according to Michael Lin, another one of the Chinese partners, who what? Close ties, highest levels, Chinese intelligence, said Hunter's role in the venture was pretty straightforward. Open as many doors as possible in the Western world for this very famous Bohai professional team. And there was also the expectation that Hunter and his partners would join some of the meetings in Hong Kong and China that they arrange when communicating with possible financial partners. Although he would later claim publicly that this private equity deal was not really that lucrative, Hunter's private correspondence shows otherwise. Regarding the Super Chairman Fund, he wrote in an email in September 2011, things are moving rapidly, and the percentage he is offering me is much larger than I at first thought. Archer thought the deal made sense, not only on its own merits from an economic standpoint, but from the leverage and access it provides with the big boys here in the West who all need China. Hunter Biden saw dollar signs. I don't believe in lottery tickets anymore, he wrote to Archer, but I do believe in the super chairman. I think the sky's the limit. The Bohai negotiations continued over several months. The email correspondence suggests that the Chinese partners did not expect Hunter Biden and the other Americans to be actively involved in the fund, that they would do most of the heavy lifting. As Bulger explained to Hunter and Archer, if all Jonathan needs from us is to sit on the investment committee, then it might not be a bad deal. If our involvement is simply to sit on the sidelines and be the white face, then I'm personally close to a 15% stake. By the spring of 2013, the Bohai deal was in the final negotiation stage. In June, the principals met in Beijing to go over the terms. Although the Biden lawyers claimed Hunter wasn't involved in the final discussions, according to Secret Service travel records, Hunter was in Beijing between June 13th and June 15th. In December 2013, Hunter returned to Beijing, this time arriving on Air Force Two with his father. Vice President Biden was grappling with a multitude of issues between the United States and China. He held high-level meetings with China officials, and what Hunter spent his time doing in the meanwhile is less clear. However, he later admitted that he had introduced his dad to his business partner, Jonathan Lee, in the lobby of their hotel. And you will also remember that Joe Biden said at no time ever did he ever speak to any of his family members, including his son, about any of their business dealings, anywhere, anyway, anyhow. Never happened. End of story. 10 days after that, Bohai Harvest Company was registered in Beijing. Hunter was later offered a 10% equity stake in the business and a board seat. The equity stake required him to put in capital, but he apparently did not have enough. So Chinese executives gave him a loan, guaranteeing him a stake in the billion-dollar-plus investment firm. In January of 14, just 1 month after the finalized Bohai Harvest deal, Hunter and Devin made plans to meet with the Chinese ambassador in Washington. The purpose of the meeting is unclear. Bohai Harvest released a prospectus for investors noting that Hunter Biden served on the board. They never mentioned Joe Biden per se, but Hunter was also listed as the honorary co-chair of the 2009 Presidential Inaugural Committee of the United States. Bohai Harvest noted that Rosemont Seneca brought extensive political and business networks in America and Europe to the table. Hunter Biden figured prominently in Bohai Harvest materials that were sent to Chinese investors. Bohai, in their 2016 annual report, had a graphic titled Global Network and included a world map and a photo of Hunter Biden with other partners and an arrow pointing to New York City. Now, the super chairman would fade from the deal as both he and Ma were arrested and charged with money laundering and bribery, respectively. However, the partnership between Hunter and the Chinese officials was off and running, and Henry Zhao would arrange other deals with Hunter Biden. Bohai Harvest was not simply an investment fund engaged in ordinary commercial arrangements. Given the intelligence and the political ties of those setting up Bohai Harvest, it should not come as a surprise that Hunter's Fund began buying or investing in strategically important companies in China and the United States. One of their earlier investments was in the China General Nuclear Power Corporation. Hunter's firm was an anchor investor. Now, the FBI would later expose that firm as a conduit for nuclear espionage in the West. In April 2016, CGN and a CG engineer named Alan Ho were charged by the Obama Justice Department with stealing nuclear secrets from the United States. Actions, prosecutors said, could cause significant damage to our national security. Hunter Biden, son of the vice president, is invested in this company. A major, an anchor investor in a company that is actively stealing nuclear secrets, damaging nuclear secrets. So Hunter Biden's Bohai Harvest is also contributing to the undermining of our national defense, buying companies in the United States that have clear military application that now would benefit Beijing in its strategic competition with the United States. Bohai Harvest bought an American company called Heneges Automotive, a firm that was known for anti-vibration technologies that had certain pretty important military as well as civilian applications. The Chinese military's interest in the company is obvious, given that Bohai Harvest also partnered with the Aviation Industry Corporation of China to close the deal. AVIC is one of China's largest military contractors. U.S. officials have identified the Aviation Industry Corporation of China as a major culprit in the theft of United States defense technologies. Hunter Biden invested in them. Now, how much has and will Hunter ultimately make on just this one China deal? It's impossible to say. Team Biden absurdly claims that his stake in the firm is only $420,000. But recall Hunter's enthusiastic email comparing the deal to winning the lottery. It's difficult to imagine, says Professor Stephen Kaplan from the University of Chicago School of Business, if not incomprehensible, a 10% stake in those economics is only worth $420,000. If we use other investments as a guide, using other investment funds and their performance as a guide for that time, Hunter's take on the BHR deal is probably closer to $20 million. Still got a little bit of time. I'm going to take a drink because all this talking, frankly, makes a man thirsty. And you guys need to, yeah, close ties to the highest levels of Chinese intelligence is the phrase of the day, is the sentence fragment of the day. probably, from a technical perspective, the greatest guitar player on earth. And that is, of course, the one and only Chet Atkins. I don't think I have ever heard anybody play so technically perfect ever. I don't care who you are. Mark Knopfler, Jimi Hendrix, Eddie Van Halen, Richie Rhodes, doesn't matter, I don't care who you are. Nobody was better. Just absolutely clean, flawless. Well, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to stop right there for a moment. Now, here's the thing. At some point in all these deals, someone in this group, this brain trust, had to know or were able to otherwise find out that all the people that they were dealing with were tight with Chinese intelligence. They had to know. Is it conceivable that they didn't? Probably, yeah, maybe. I'm not buying it. Okay? These business whizzes are supposed to be brains, man. They're supposed to be the heads. All right? Now, Hunter Biden, we know,
what a stupid son of a...
Thanks. Yeah, exactly, Joe. There you go. Chip off the old block. There, you just heard it out of Joe and stuff. Anyway, John Kerry was Secretary of State. Okay, he's an idiot, yes, but he was also Secretary of State. He knew who called the shots in China's intelligence community. His stepson, 57, what did we say we were going to call him? Eddie Hines. His stepson, Eddie, was involved in these deals. Do you think that there weren't names that rung a bell from his experience in State Department, his classified security clearance? Well, of course they knew. They didn't give any. It didn't matter. This is like Glenn Frey told us in Smuggler's Blues, the lure of easy money has a very strong appeal. It's the ultimate enticement. I mean, you get a guy like Hooker, like Hunter, who digs, you know, whores and smoking crack. You got him. You got him. These people are scum. And it doesn't end here. It ends here for this evening. Here ends the lesson for this evening. But we're going to be going back, definitely looking over it. I'm going to go ahead and bookmark us right there. Okay, now the things that we're talking about, number one, were documented and confirmed without question in 2018's book, Secret Empires. And they talked about the Clintons, they talked about the Bidens, they talked about Nancy Pelosi, they talked about Schumer, they talked about McConnell. Mitch McConnell. And I don't think I'm going to have time to get into it tonight, but I'll be covering over the next couple of weeks because we're going to be talking about this on the recorded show. We're going to be talking about this on the live program as well. And all this, these negative outcomes, these negative impacts that we're having all extend from liberalism, from extreme leftism. And I really shouldn't say liberalism. But that's the name, that's the nomenclature. Now, Pete McCardle over at American Thinker has come up with a Jeff Foxworthy riff. Michael Savage has said for years, and many others have taken his cue and reiterated, liberalism is a mental disease. It is a dangerous mental disease. And the only chance you have of regaining sanity is with early treatment. And so, always looking to be of help, Pete McCardle has compiled a checklist of liberal beliefs so that concerned readers can gauge whether or not they're a budding liberal in need of an intervention. So without any further ado, you might be a liberal if you think having your penis amputated and your Adam's apple shaved makes you a woman. You might be a liberal if you think that a deadly virus emanating from a city with a level 4 biohazard virology lab actually came from an animal at the neighboring food market. If you know Democrats made it super easy to cheat in 2020 with early voting, with mail-in voting, with ballot harvesting, and the eschewing, which means doing away with for those of you in Daniels, West Virginia, of voter ID, yet you believe no widespread cheating occurred, you might be a liberal. If you're certain that the crime wave sweeping the country has nothing to do with Democrats defunding and denigrating the police, emptying the jails, and greatly diminishing or eliminating our bail system, you could be a liberal. If you think Joe Biden's hair, teeth, or compassion for his fellow man are real, you might be a liberal. If you're ready to block traffic and burn buildings and loot stores and spit on cops when annually a handful of black men are wrongfully killed by police, but you'd never leave the comfort of your lazy boy for the handful of black men murdered in Chicago every weekend, hell, every day, you might be a liberal. If you watch CNN's human potato, Brian Stelter, educating school kids on how to spot misinformation and you don't laugh uncontrollably, you might be a liberal. If you think Kamala Harris is smart, charismatic, and a great communicator, ditto for the Hildebeest, you might be a liberal. If you're fine with vagrants masturbating, pooping, and shooting up on city sidewalks, but you would berate your teenager for doing those things in your front yard, you might be a liberal. If you approve of criminals and terrorists and drug dealers and sex traffickers and some, I assume, nice people pouring across our southern border yet, you have a nice tall fence around your home, deadbolt locks on all your doors, and a state-of-the-art alarm system, you might be a liberal. If you wore surgical masks, practiced social distancing, quarantined when indicated, and soldiered through the bad side effects of not one, but two COVID vaccinations plus a booster, yet you still contracted the virus and a month later have not fully recovered from it, still, you tell a pollster, you strongly approve of the job Tony Fauci, a multimillionaire on a civil service salary, has done fighting the pandemic? Yes. All indications are you could be a liberal. If you firmly believe that Jeffrey Epstein killed himself, that his guards simply fell asleep, and the jail's video cameras just happened to be inoperative at the time of Epstein's death, and you're certain the Clintons had nothing to do with it, yes, you might be a liberal. If you think roads, trees, credit scores, punctuality, math, climate change, professionalism, and proper English grammar are irredeemably racist, you might be a liberal. If you'd strongly support the termination and dismemberment of unborn babies at any time in a pregnancy for any reason, and you're fine with abortion clinics selling fetal body parts, but you'd never in a million years watch the actual procedure, yeah, you're probably a liberal. Although vaccinated, boosted, fully recovered from a nasty bout of COVID, you wear two masks and a face shield while driving in your car alone. And there's an old faded I'm with her sticker on your rear bumper. You are definitely a liberal. There are a lot more to this, but I'm going to go ahead and close up with what about. But, okay, there's just too many leftist beliefs to list to go on and write. You write a whole book. So anyway, if you agreed... By the way, if you agreed with any of the above statements or maybe something in those above statements kind of resonated positively with you, you need to see a doctor too sweet. Maybe Dr. Jill Biden. Whoopi Goldberg says she's a hell of a doctor. Now, as we go on, and we're going to go on and on, we're going to name names. Schweitzer has done this, and everybody, and I mean everybody in the United States, everybody in the world needs to know what he's done. And I'm going to do my piddly little part to make sure that happens. How can we keep it from happening? How do we stop this? How do we end this? How do we excise this malignant tumor of corruption from the body politic? At least, well, maybe not where China's concerned, just in general, okay? How do we do it? See, here's where I'm going to go all Cutler on you. I've taken you all over the place with the Chinese people who are what? Close ties to the highest levels of Chinese intelligence. We're going to tie it all together. How do we stop it from happening? I've said it a million times. I'm going to say it again. An informed and disseminating electorate. That's how we keep it from happening. Now, there are other things that can be done as well. This takes care of the people who are actively engaged in politics, who are currently occupying office. But see, it's worse than that. What about these guys who leave office and get into the lobbying business? See, this is a very dangerous thing, too. And in the book, we're going to talk about 23 former U.S. senators and congressmen who now currently lobby for Chinese military or Chinese intelligence-linked companies. And most of them are Republicans. Yeah. This is something else that we have to look at, too. When they leave office, the lobbyists, this is another thing that has to be taken apart and unpacked and looked at as to what can be done. But an informed and disseminating electorate. That's how we stop this. And it's ongoing. It never ends. It is perpetual. It has to be. Barry Goldwater, a great American and a great conservative, once said that the price of peace is constant vigilance. And he was absolutely right. He said it at the height of the Cold War in the 1960s. We were involved with the war in Vietnam, we were involved with dealing with Russia, we were looking at proxy war, we had looked at a proxy war in Korea with Russia and China, we were doing it again in Vietnam, and all the other little places throughout the world, in Africa, in South America, where communist infiltration was rampant, and we were doing what we could to stop. We have to look at these people very closely. from your city council, from your boards, your state and county boards of education, your local school boards, your city councils, your county commissions, your local state houses, your state legislatures, and then the people that we send to Washington. We have to look at them very carefully. And when we find them deviating from what we want them to do, then we have to take steps to remove them from office, which means what? We vote them out in the next election quickly as possible. We primary somebody against them. We get them out. We remove them. And maybe they can't perform. Maybe they overpromised. Maybe they can't deliver on what they said they could. Maybe they lack the political will or the political acumen to do so. They got to go. And we got to get people in there who will. It never ends. It can't stop with your local school board any more than it can stop with your state houses or with legislators in Congress and in the Senate in Washington, D.C. It simply cannot. And when they come up short, they have to go, whether through corruption, whether through ineptitude, whether through fecklessness or thievery, because a lot of times, and I've said it a million times, Harry Truman said it's impossible, man, to get rich in politics. It simply cannot be done. Orrin Hatch once said it's impossible to go to Washington and return an honest man. And that may well be true as well. Also, that may be, that was terrible. That may well be, and that may as well, that may be true. Yeah, he's probably right, Tip. That may be as well also, is what I was trying to say. And that's when they got to go. So again, a disseminating and informed electorate, we got to pay attention. We got to pay attention to what their positions are. We got to pay attention to why they're doing what they do. Is it in the best interest? Is it what we agreed upon sending them to Washington or to the school board or to the county commission or city council? Is that what we agreed that they were going to do? And if they're breaching our agreement, if they're violating our contract, then we got to get them out of there. And we have to make a lot of noise about it. We have to voice our displeasure. Who is this? Hi, little baby. Dixie coming downstairs. Hey, babe. How's the girl? So if they're not capable of doing it, then they have to go. They just got to go. They just got to go. And we can't show remorse. We can't show pity for these people. They have a job to do. Their commitment was to do what needed to be done in the best interests of their constituency. And if they're not doing it, or their constituency becomes narrowed to the point of themselves and their family and friends, then we got a problem and they have to go again. It's very, very simple. And we may have to be ruthless about it. We talk all this noise about term limits, and on the one hand, I say, yeah, that's right. Term limits make sense. That's a good deal. They can only be in there for so long, and then, you know, we can get them out of there and get somebody else in that maybe won't do as much damage or maybe do a little bit better. And I think it's good. But at the same time, I say, hell, we voted them in. What precludes us from voting them back out? Why do we need – we are the term limit. The term limits are established by an informed and disseminating electorate. It doesn't have to be. You think those guys are gonna ratify, they're going to codify term limits? Seriously? A couple of the more moral ones at the time being, you know, if they were fresh when they got in there to do it, probably. But no, they're not going to do it. We have to do it. We're the term limits, the informed and disseminating electorate. It can't be any other way. When the Declaration was signed, Ben Franklin walked out onto the street and a woman asked him, you know, what do we got? He says, a republic, madam, if you can keep it. Adams says the Constitution of the United States is suited for the governance of a moral and wholesome people. It is useless to anybody else. And he's right about that, too. So there are things that we have to look at within the country. And I don't think that we can look for metrics or baselines in morality from a segment of the population that thinks it's okay to, instead of getting the much-needed psychological treatment that you need, to go ahead and have all of society, nay, the entire world, enable a sick individual, a man, who woke up one morning and decided that he identifies as a woman, which gives him the right to go into ladies' restrooms, to go into ladies' locker rooms. If he commits a crime, being sent to a women's prison. That's mindlessness, sheer mindlessness. The remedy, I'll say it again, an informed and disseminating electorate. And you know what? Michael has talked about this. Kesterson talked about this in the old days of the American Brand Radio Initiative back when I was working with him for a little while. Talk to your neighbors. It's not going to hurt anything. I know we think, you know, good fences make for good neighbors, and that's true. And I love neighbors who mind their own business and wave, oh, we're done, and wave when they go to their house, and I wave, and we don't bother each other. Talk to them. Maybe it's nothing. Maybe it's a good morning. Maybe it's about the weather. Maybe it's about what's going on. And just see. You don't have to judge them. You don't have to be critical. Hell, you don't even have to tell them where you stand. But talk to them. See what happens. That's all the time we got, folks. ACP Heard here live Thursday or Tuesdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, the recorded incarnation of the program. Going out, thank you, Penelope. Going out over the Mojo 50 Radio Network, Sundays, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's all the time we got, folks. Thanks for the opportunity to hang out with you. We will be back soon, as soon as we can, taking a look at things as we do through a conservative perspective. In the meantime, God bless you. God bless America. You guys take really good care of yourselves, and we will see you soon.